Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, August 6, 2014. Today, we focus primarily on the creeping police state in these United States. Lady Gaga? Packing a smartphone right on your bum there? Most Americans do these days. And we learned a few months ago from a court case in Tallahassee, Florida, that the federal government has deployed to local law enforcement agencies a powerful suite of devices that we know collectively as Stingray. And today, in a detailed, exclusive, in-depth interview with investigative journalist Bo Hodai, we take a very close look at Stingray, at the Harris Corporation, which manufactures and sells these devices, the way Harris claims non-disclosure agreements prevent local law enforcement agencies from honoring the Constitution and notifying prosecutors, defense attorneys, and judges that evidence or prosecutions were derived from illegal surveillance that didn't have a warrant? Well, this is quite a blockbuster. And I want to credit Bo Hodai, who is an independent journalist who does his own research very carefully. And he publishes detailed investigative reports. This one is 33 pages long. And I invite you to read it for yourself at his website, dbapress.com. Here's an excerpt from my detailed interview with Bo Hodai, in which he describes that when the Stingray, which is a cell site simulator, I'm going to have to say that again, Stingray, which is a cell site simulator, in other words, it is brought in a van or some other mobile device, it's put in a specific geographical location, and it allows cell phone traffic to pass through it. But as it does, it collects all the metadata, who's calling who, it collects geographical information, where are they calling from, and who is the call being received by, where are they? And as you know, metadata is extremely powerful. And we know that the Stingray system has been abused. It's not just being used for terrorism cases or national security cases. We've seen a mission creep down to rather remarkably low levels of criminals and fugitives. But in this excerpt from our interview, Bo Hodai describes how when a Stingray system is activated in your area, thousands of innocent people's phone calls are collected along with those of alleged suspects.
The use of the Stingray system, where you would use it to identify interpersonal relationship graphs, and you know they have equipment that actually does create actual graphs. So you have people that are, quote, innocent, who you know are just people that are related in some way or who are called by the subject of an investigation that are not guilty of any crime. And then, as I believe you mentioned, you have the other innocent data, the people who are just happen to be in the area of a Stingray device's operation, because the device does not differentiate at all whose phone it's interrogating data from. That's actually a integral part to the operation of the device. So, you know, say, for example, you have the identifying information for a phone, and that's if you have it. The Stingray system is also used to gain that information, which includes even more search of even more innocent data. So if you have the identifying information for a specific phone, you turn on the Stingray device, and it causes all cellular devices in its area of operation to log in, and then it forces registration with the device or to communicate with it, and then it mines those phones for that identification number. So, you know, after a, like say in a tracking operation, after that one phone has been logged into, then they may only pursue one phone. But before they can even do that, they have to mine the data from all of the phones in the area. So it's basically impossible to use this thing in any way that's not a, you know, just a general search, which is unconstitutional.
The full interview with Bo Hodiat runs over an hour. It's available today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com. And I also want to recommend that you support the independent investigative work of Bo Hodiat. The full-length report at DBA Press is available for a subscription over there, a one-time payment of $15. And Bo doesn't have a major media outlet or a foundation that underwrites his work. He is completely independent. And so I encourage you to purchase his report because I think you'll learn a lot from it. And in doing so, you will support important investigative work. And I know Bo has more in the pipeline. And this stingray system raises a lot of very critical issues. For example, we know that because the law enforcement agencies that use it claim that the Harris non-disclosure agreement prevents them from notifying courts of where the incriminating evidence came from, that law enforcement now engages in what is called parallel construction. All right? So let's say they catch you and me in a compromising telephone call. They can't use that bit of evidence against us. But once they know that whatever was contained in that phone call, once they know that, then they can look for other ways to prove that we were involved in a drug deal or smuggling arms to Al-Shabaab or, you know, some other criminal activity. And then they look for ways to pursue the prosecution without revealing that it was originally based on this illegally acquired evidence. And we see that despite the recent Supreme Court ruling that the contents of your cell phone are private, they're covered by the Fourth Amendment, and law enforcement can't just grab your phone, copy it, or read your important information or your contacts? Well, I believe that Stingray would receive the same reception from the U.S. Supreme Court. But, of course, there is no evidence that it's being used. There's no evidence of the wrongdoing that we're alleging here, at least not officially. And in the interview and in the detailed report, Bo Hodiat tells the frightening story of a woman in Sarasota, Florida, named Louise Goldsberry. She's a nurse, and she, by all accounts, is a pretty strong woman. And one night, a group of heavily armed, and she didn't know initially that they were police officers, approached her condo complex. And when she saw an armed goon outside her window while she was doing the dishes, she stood her ground, like they say in Florida. And she ended up in an armed confrontation. She pulled out her gun. She pointed it at the guy with the assault rifle. And fortunately, shots were not exchanged. But it's believed that the raid on her condo in Sarasota was the product of a stingray surveillance effort. There is much more in the in-depth interview and in Bo Hodiat's detailed report. And I hope you will access each of them, the podcast at peterbcollins.com and the detailed report at dbapress.com. Well, the creeping police state certainly has raised a lot of hackles, and more Americans are becoming aware of it. And it's interesting because Missouri, which you know is the show-me state, voters went to the polls yesterday for their primary election, and 75% of them voted yes on Amendment 9. Amendment 9 is a state-level nullification of federal government spying by the NSA or any other agency. And this remarkably simple solution, or at least it's a proposed remedy, is a single phrase that was inserted into the Constitution of the state of Missouri. And I will tell you that the language that was present there before said, "The people shall be secure in their persons, papers, homes, effects from unreasonable searches and seizures." And after the word effects, The Amendment 9 adds the phrase, and electronic communications and data. That's all it does. But the power of it. Oh, and there are a couple of other phrases related to that, saying that you can't seize any person or thing or access electronic data or communication without a warrant. And the information I have here from the proponents of this measure, which is the 10th Amendment Center, and they are linked to Panda Unite, the activist group opposing the NDAA's detention provisions from 2012. Well, the analysis says that a state constitutional amendment only binds state agencies and not the federal government, but it will protect the citizens of Missouri from a practical effect of federal spying. By prohibiting state agents from accessing warrantless electronic data, it makes such data gathered by federal agencies like the NSA and shared with state and local law enforcement agencies inadmissible in state criminal proceedings. And this tightens up the loophole that is apparently prevailing in the use of the Stingray system by local law enforcement across the country, where they don't notify the courts of where the evidence came from. They don't actually attempt to introduce the surveillance evidence, but they use parallel construction. And so I think this is a very interesting effort, and to see that 75% of the voters in the Missouri primary supported this Amendment 9, well, that gives me a little hope. Just a little bit of hope that Americans are waking up to this creeping police state around us. Today over at The Intercept, which of course is owned by the billionaire Pierre Omidyar and employs some great reporters like Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill, Scahill and Ryan Devereaux published a piece that has a lot of important information, and there are a couple of factors here that I'll address in a moment after I give you the meat of the story. And that is that the Obama administration was so concerned about this that they used an official leak to try to undermine the journalistic scoop that The Intercept deserves here. And secondly, that this information is based on a new source, a new whistleblower, because the evidence cited here surfaced after Ed Snowden had moved to Moscow and stopped leaking. The subject is the terrorist tracking system of the federal government. These are the watch lists, the terrorist screening database, the no-fly list. You've heard about these, and you've heard these frightening Orwellian or Kafkaesque stories. That once people get on a no-fly list or a terrorist watch list, no one will explain to them why they are there, and there is no mechanism for them to get their names removed. And we had the remarkable case here in a court in San Francisco in the past year where a woman from Malaysia or Indonesia who was studying at Stanford was attempting to fly home for the holidays when she was notified that she's on a no-fly list. After years of litigation, the government found that there was no evidence to support any terrorist connections for this person. And then the government secretly whispered in the ear of the judge, who turned 180 degrees on a dime and refused to order her name removed from the watch list. So what Scahill and his colleague are reporting is the actual numbers of people on these watch lists and the remarkable growth under President Obama. Citing federal court filings by government lawyers, the report is that there have been 1.5 million names added to the watch list over the past 5 years. Now, think about that. 1.5 million new names on this list. And what is that based on? There is no known or publicized terrorist threat against the United States and our homeland that could possibly justify that. But, of course, it's all secret, And when you challenge this, they just tell you to sit down and shut up. Because it's a secret and it's going to stay that way. So, there are 1 million names in the so-called TIDE database. Then there are 680,000 of those people who are on watch lists. And the breakdown continues. There are 47,000 on a no-fly list. 16,000 are called selectees who get groped even more deeply when they go to an airport. And of that number, which appears to be, 47 plus 16, so it's about 80,000 people, 20,000 of them are U.S. persons. And I'm going to link to this story. It is detailed and full of facts, full of new disclosures that your government doesn't want you to know. For example, there are 611,000 men on the primary terrorist watch list and 39,000 women. That's just interesting as a statistic. The top nominating agencies responsible for placing people on the watch list are the CIA, the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, the NSA, and the FBI. The top five cities in the U.S. represented on the main watch list for known or suspected terrorists are New York, Dearborn, Michigan, which of course is the home of many Arab immigrants, second and third generation included, Houston, San Diego, and Chicago. And the Dearborn is a real case of racial profiling and religious profiling. My brother-in-law works in Dearborn, where he is the executive director of the Arab American Museum. It's no secret that there are many people of Arabic and Middle Eastern descent who came to Detroit to work in the auto industry decades ago. And yet, I can't think of a single case except that the underwear bomber was flying to Detroit, where Dearborn in particular should be singled out as one of the places, the top five cities in the country. They don't even include Detroit. It's just Dearborn, which has a population of under 100,000 people. So it's quite a report. I encourage you to take a look at it. The link is in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. Every day I pause to thank the people who support my work trying to expose the creeping police state in this country, like Richard Attlee, Andy Betmanis, Don Cisney, and Abby McMillan. Thanks to each and every one of you, and I want to invite people who aren't currently supporting us, who can afford it, to step on over to peterbcollins.com. Under my picture, there's a link that says sign up, takes you to a page where you get to choose. You can listen to my extended interview with Bo Hodai for just $1. Get a 24-hour pass for that. Or you can sign up for a monthly subscription at $5, $10, $20, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers in the U.S. get a copy of John Dist's rock and roll CD with powerful political lyrics in it. It's called Red Flag. Now, the story I was just talking about, the Scahill-Devereaux expose at The Intercept, as I alluded to at the beginning, was the subject of an attempt, it appears, by our government to undermine the exclusive, the scoop, the first report of The Intercept. And I want to credit David Holmes at Pando.com, who, first of all, credits The Intercept and First Look Media, which is the parent, with a very important story. And I give Pando credit for saying that because Pando has been tweaking Glenn Greenwald, Pierre Omidyar, The Intercept, First Look, because it's not really a very transparent organization, and there are a lot of important questions that haven't been addressed about conflicts of interest and who Omidyar's loyalties lie with. But Pando correctly praises Scahill and Devereaux's reporting And then says it's a huge story and a major scoop. Or at least it would have been a major scoop had the Associated Press not published the story a few minutes earlier. Well, according to a report by Ryan Grimm at Huffington Post, the National Counterterrorism Center spoiled the scoop by tipping off the Associated Press that Intercept was about to publish, or at least preparing a story. A source told Grimm that the Intercept, after seeing the AP story, promptly hopped onto a conference call with people at the NCTC, the National Counterterrorism Center, during which an official reportedly said the agency didn't expect the AP reporter to publish the story first. That was our bad, the official said. But let me underscore. Ed Snowden can't come back to the United States because he leaked important official information that was declared secret. Chelsea Manning will spend the rest of her life behind bars for her disclosures. And yet, in response to this new leaker, and I'll get to that aspect next, the Obama administration saw fit to leak information. And this is what is so pernicious about the atmosphere in Washington, where the Obama administration has, you know, expanded secret programs, expanded the watch lists, declared that all of it is off limits to the courts, to the media. Torture victims can't seek any remedy in our courts, all blocked by the Obama administration. And while Bush was bad, Obama is worse, and the numbers of people on watch lists, the numbers of people who've been subject to surveillance under this administration, have grown exponentially. And even as they crack down brutally on leakers, they leak whenever they damn well want to. And that's what's really insidious about this sequence of events. Now, as I mentioned, the Scahill-Devereaux story is based on documents that could not have come from Ed Snowden because they are dated August 2013, when it's very clear that Ed Snowden was in Moscow and had nothing left to leak. And so the spooks got their antennas up, and they're looking for the new leaker who exposed the watch lists and all of those details. And I'm looking here now at a story that appeared on CNN's website that notes that in February, Glenn Greenwald said, "I definitely think it's fair to say there are people who have been inspired by Snowden's courage and by the great good and virtue it's achieved. I have no doubt there will be other sources inside the government who see extreme wrongdoing who are inspired by Ed Snowden." And it's interesting because the documents shared by the new and unnamed, unknown leaker fall below the top secret level of documents that were in the Snowden cache. This no watch list has a secret and no foreign designation, but it is not considered top secret. On to the other struggle in Washington over the creeping police state in this country. The battle over publication of the so-called review of CIA torture tactics, detention tactics, rendition tactics, conducted by the Senate Intelligence Committee. It's coming up on the second birthday of the completion of this report, and that birthday may pass before we see it. And while I'm sharply critical of Dianne Feinstein, who kept quiet while the torture was going on and she was briefed on all this shit, to her credit, she is not laying down and allowing the collusion of the Obama White House with CIA Director Brennan and former CIA directors, including George Tenet, to eliminate so much information from this report that there isn't evidence to support some of its important conclusions. Feinstein said the CIA redactions from the report's executive summary are unacceptable, and until the snipped sections are restored, she will not allow the report to be made public. Quote from the senator, the redactions eliminate or obscure key facts that support the report's findings and conclusions. The report will not be released until I am satisfied that all redactions are appropriate. Now, she's got a big ego, but in this case, block the door with it, Diane. I don't care. Feinstein added that the bottom line is the United States must never again make the mistakes documented in this report. I believe in this report. I believe the best way to accomplish that is to make public our thorough documentary history of the CIA's program. Feinstein said the document, referred to as the Panetta Review, that was the hot potato that the Intelligence Committee investigators found, and then when the CIA counterparts got wind of it, they tried to steal it from the Senate's computer that was in a secured room controlled by the CIA. That Panetta Review, we're told, confirmed that the conclusions of the Intelligence Committee are correct. And Feinstein goes on to say, the CIA's own analysts provided acknowledgement of significant CIA wrongdoing and corroborate critical information in the committee's study that the CIA's official response either objects to, denies, minimizes, or ignores. And here comes a voice of a man who knows what price you pay if you expose the truth about U.S. government torture. Do you remember Antonio Taguba? Well, he's retired now as a major general from the United States Army. And in an op-ed published today, or actually yesterday, August 5th, in the New York Times, he writes, we know that CIA torture was more widespread and brutal than Americans were led to believe. And he speculates the committee has also found that the CIA misled Bush administration officials and Congress about the extent and nature of the torture. And here's where he brings in his personal experience. Yet I know that oversight will help the CIA as it helped the United States military. 10 years ago, I was directed by Lieutenant General Sanchez, the senior officer in Iraq, to investigate allegations of detainee abuse at the Abu Ghraib prison. My report's findings, which prompted a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing, documented a systemic problem. Military personnel had perpetrated numerous incidents of sadistic, blatant, and wanton criminal abuses. Taguba was a courageous man. He continues, the findings, along with what became infamous images of abuse, caused a stir and led to prosecutions. The inquiry shed light on our country's trip to the dark side, in which the United States government engaged in an assault on American ideals, broke the law, and in so doing, strengthened our enemies. Now, I understand the general's posture here and what he wrote, but when he said there were prosecutions for Abu Ghraib, let's remember, nobody who allowed that, no senior official, no officer who was in charge of it, was held accountable. A female general who was nominally in charge of Abu Ghraib was denied promotion and pushed out. But the people held accountable were Lindy England, I think her name was, and Charlie Grainer. A couple, I think both of them were married to people in the United States, but they were having wild sexual escapades as they abused their charges at Abu Ghraib and had them pose for sexually charged photos in the nude, you know, all that stuff. But I believe Grainer, who held the rank of sergeant, was the highest ranking person held to account for the ugly actions at Abu Ghraib. So Taguba then describes the price that he paid. The military's path to accountability, he writes, was a long one, and its leaders hardly welcomed oversight. A few months after I completed the investigation, I was reassigned to the office of the Secretary of Defense, where I could be closely monitored. Then, in early 2006, I received a phone call from General Richard Cody, the Army's Chief of Staff, Vice Chief of Staff, who said, I need you to retire by January of next year. No explanation was given. None was needed. So, General Tacuba, I admire you. I appreciate you speaking up in this context. I imagine that Dianne Feinstein called you and said, Antonio, could you please write an op-ed? But however this was generated, I welcome your voice to this important debate. And finally today, for boomers like me who grew up listening to the music of the Doors, Jim Morrison, Ray Manzarek, Robbie Krieger, and John Densmore. I love their music, one of my early influences. And then Jim Morrison overdosed in Paris. I believe it was in the summer of 1972. And it brought quite an end to what it had been an amazing band with a lot of influence on the development of rock and roll. That's the voice of Jim Morrison. I did a little Dynamite an hour ago. Well, finally, it's been revealed how Jim Morrison died. The British singer Marianne Faithfull, who at one point was kind of a groupie for the Rolling Stones, but she went on to establish herself as a talented individual. And I arranged to bring Marianne Faithfull to the United States to appear at a conference that I produced, the Music Journalism Awards in Los Angeles, about 1995. And because of her own past use of drugs, she was on a watch list, if you can believe that. And through the help of some people in a local congressional office, we got immigration to let Marianne Faithfull into the country. So she revealed recently to a British journalist that her boyfriend was responsible for the death of Jim Morrison in July of 1971, not 72, as I had said. In an interview with Mojo, she claimed that Jean de Brutieu, a heroin dealer, and her boyfriend at the time, gave Jim Morrison the drugs that killed him. Faithfull told Mojo he went to see Jim Morrison and killed him. I mean, I'm sure it was an accident, poor bastard. The smack was too strong? Yeah. And he died. And I didn't know anything about this. Anyway, everybody connected to the death of this poor guy is dead now, except me. And Faithfull said she could have joined her boyfriend on his visit to Morrison, but decided not to. Intuitively, I could feel trouble. I thought instead I'll take a few two and all, and I won't be there. Well, I thought Jim Morrison was an amazing talent. And I continue to miss his voice, his out-of-control behavior, and his over-the-top public performances. We'll give Roy Rogers the day off and ride into the sunset here with this incredible song, L.A. Woman. You know they are a liar. Driving down your freeway. Midnight alleys roam. Cops and cars.